So back when Sean was a mere 7 years old, a drunk guy at a cookout told him that if you eat the white part of a watermelon, it'll give you diarrhea. He actually said it a little more colorfully than that, but let's go with that for now. Sean held on to that belief for more than 30 years, always being careful to avoid the white part of a slice of watermelon. When he finally got the nerve up to test this particular belief, which I have to say was like in the last 5 years, he of course learned it was not true. And now he and my daughter have a delightfully giggly time eating the white part of a slice of watermelon. Now, sure, this particular belief didn't impact Sean's quality of life, but plenty of our beliefs do. The beliefs we hold leave an indelible mark on the way we interact with others and our environment, even when those beliefs aren't conscious. It's taken me many years to begin the process of deconstructing my beliefs about friendship. Almost every message we get about friendship, starting when we're just toddlers, is about how friends enrich our lives. Being a good friend and having lots of friends makes life better, right? I believed that to be a universal truth. So I saw my own reality through that belief, and that reality looked kind of incomplete and sad. I've never had a big group of friends. Instead, I can handle about one or two close relationships at a time. When I was younger, I blamed other people for this perceived deficit in my life. But as I became an adult, I blamed myself. Not having a gaggle of friends meant there was something wrong with me. Other people seemed to effortlessly juggle a circle of close friends, while I felt overwhelmed at the very idea of it. When I asked my therapist about whether this was okay a couple of years back, she told me, and this was perfect, if you're asking if it's normal, no, it's not. If you're asking if it's okay, absolutely, it's fine. That distinction between normal and okay, or normal and totally fine, was quite a revelation. It was exactly what I needed to hear. And so with care and attention, I've started to integrate a new belief into my autistic worldview. I just don't need many relationships to be happy. Simple, right? But that original belief runs deep. And rooting it out is a big challenge. It takes real effort to remind myself that what others might consider a normal amount of friends doesn't have to be my normal. That fewer friends doesn't mean a lower quality of life. Beliefs about quality of life are a whole can of worms in and of themselves. Who gets to decide the relative quality of a life? Or what lives are worth living? And how do our beliefs about quality of life and worthiness impact the way we interact with others and the way we treat ourselves? I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. Now, before we jump into the rest of this episode, I wanted to give you a heads up that my new course, Rethink Work, starts February 22nd. That's a week from today if you're listening the day it comes out. Today's episode is all about rethinking the beliefs that shape us. And that's exactly what this course is about, too. We'll take a close look at 8 beliefs about work and life that shape who we are and how we live. Get all the details and join me by going to rethinkwork.club. That's rethinkwork.club. All right, so back to those questions. Who gets to decide the relative quality of a life? What lives are worth living? And how do our beliefs about quality of life and worthiness impact the way we interact with others and the way we treat ourselves? I was reminded of these questions in a startling way recently during a viewing of Star Trek Nemesis. Now, Star Trek Nemesis came out in late 2002. That means that I probably saw it in the weird little theater in my tiny college town. Shout out to the Allen Theater. But I don't have a distinct memory from that first viewing, or from any subsequent viewing, actually. Nemesis, it should be said, is one of the lesser Star Trek movies. Rotten Tomatoes ranks it as the second worst, which I am inclined to agree with, but I would put the long, boring, movie-length TNG episode Insurrection last, while Rotten Tomatoes actually puts it ahead of Nemesis. But I digress. Let me do a little bit of scene setting here. Nemesis opens with the wedding of Commander William Riker and Counselor Deanna Troi. It's been a long time coming. Captain Picard officiates, of course, and Lieutenant Commander Data provides some post-ceremony vocal entertainment. Singing a song, nothing but bluebirds. Then, before the crew can head off to Troi's homeworld for a traditional Beta Z ceremony in the nude, the Enterprise is ordered to investigate some unusual sensor readings on a planet near the Romulan neutral zone. You still with me? On the planet, Picard and Data discover a dismantled android who looks exactly like Data.
It's you.
Resemblance is striking.
With help from Lieutenant Commander Geordi LaForge, the android is put back together and reactivated. The android introduces itself as B4, and the crew surmises that B4 is a punnily named prototype of Data.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Now, B4's tech is significantly less complex than Data's, which makes it difficult to ascertain where B4 came from or why it was on the planet. Data decides to link up with B4, so he can essentially upgrade B4's processing ability and, at the same time, upload his lifetime of memories and growth to B4's neural net.
I still can't believe the captain went along with the memory download.
Captain Picard agrees that the B4 was probably designed with the same self-actualization parameters as myself.
Data wants B4 to experience the world in the same way he does.
If my memory engrams are successfully integrated into his positronic matrix, he should have all my abilities.
Yeah, but he would also have all of your memories as well. You feel comfortable with that?
I feel nothing, Geordi. It is my belief that with my memory engrams, he will be able to function as a more complete individual.
An individual more like you, you mean?
Yes.
Maybe he's not supposed to be like you, Data. Maybe he's supposed to be exactly the way he is.
That might be so. But I believe he should have the opportunity to explore his potential.
Data shows little regard for B4's agency in this situation. And by little, I mean none. Does B4 want Data's memories? Does it even want to be upgraded? And does it even have the capacity to consent to such a procedure? Data, it seems, can't be bothered to consider these ethical and moral quandaries. Data always aspires to be more human. He has said that he'd gladly give up his superior strength, processing power, and stamina to be human. He sees himself as lacking the essential qualities of humanness and won't be satisfied until he fills up that human-shaped hole in his life. As far as Data is concerned, B4 has both a data-shaped hole and a human-shaped hole in its life. Put another way, Data is always striving to be something other than he is, a something that he regards as more and better. Data wishes to be someone he cannot be, and in turn, he wishes B4 to be someone it cannot be. Data displays an attitude of techno-ableism. Techno-ableism is what Ashley Hsu, a scholar of disability studies and technology ethics, defines as, quote, a belief in the power of technology that considers the elimination of disability a good thing, something we should strive for. It's a classic form of ableism, bias against disabled people, bias in favor of non-disabled ways of life. Techno-ableism is the use of technologies to reassert those biases, often under the guise of empowerment. Star Trek is often lauded for its diversity, and rightly so when it comes to different races, both human and extraterrestrial. But its track record on disability isn't nearly as reliable. In fact, one of the features of the Star Trek universe is that technology has advanced to the point that most impairments can be eliminated. Those that can't, like LaForge's blindness, are overcome through technology. It's not that Star Trek is unaccommodating or hostile to its disabled characters. It's that there are no disabled characters. Or rather, it's that we can merrily assume there are no disabled characters. Disability is eliminated not through changing environmental and social access, but by eliminating disabled people. Or, as Hsu puts it, there is a bias in favor of non-disabled ways of life. Data believed his lack of humanity was a problem, so he was always in search of a solution. And this, Hsu explains, is at the heart of techno-ableism. Within a techno-ableist worldview, every deficit, impairment, or difference is a problem waiting for a technological solution. It's a hole waiting to be filled in with a miracle. Data does eventually get his emotion chip and takes a step closer to humanity, at least in his estimation. Unfortunately, the whole emotion chip thing doesn't go smoothly.
Advisor's picking up something in the theta band. It could be a trilithium signature. Data, we don't have time for this.
I cannot help myself. I think something is wrong.
Data? Data. Data, are you all right?
I believe the emotion chip has overloaded my positronic relay.
We better get you back to the ship. Before she enters.
As a kid watching and relating to Data, I also learned a bias against disabled ways of life. I learned that it was better to strive to be like everyone else than to be myself. I learned that my useful quirks could be handy to have around, but that no matter how useful, those quirks would never buy me acceptance or belonging. If only I had had my own emotion chip to install. Data believes his life would be better if he were human. Just as so many non-disabled people assume life would be worse if they became disabled or chronically ill. Now, I don't want to ignore the fact that many forms of disability do come with loss, trauma, and pain. However, it's one thing to deal with loss or treat pain, and another thing to wish it all, including the disabled person, away. Hsu writes, quote, so many of our stories about technology and disability are about technologies as redemptive, as having the power to normalize disabled people, to make us overcome our disabilities. When Data attempts the link with B4, he erases the person B4 has been to that point, which is to say that B4 had not been Data to that point. But ideally, after the link, B4 will be Data for all intents and purposes. B4 will have overcome his not Data-ness. He'll be redeemed through technology. This story, or ones like it, play out in our self-judgment regularly. I reference Shu's work on techno-ableism because it shows just how harmful these judgments can be. However, this overcoming narrative affects all of us, disabled or not, in a variety of ways. We learn from an early age that difference is something to be overcome through any means necessary. We learn to mask, to code switch, to change the size and shape of our bodies. We learn to speak like a news anchor, to color or process our hair, to dress in a way that signals we're just like everybody else. While we might not have someone else bypass our agency and link directly into our brain to perform an update, authority figures from parents to teachers to bosses to politicians regularly reminded us to explore our potential in a way that really means our ability to assimilate. Our ideas of who to become, what to strive for, and how to conduct our lives are shaped by what others believe is a more complete individual. Resistance, in this case, is not futile. It's essential. When we question the beliefs we've inherited about our differences, we learn to see our differences objectively rather than morally. We realize that we get to choose what we want to overcome, if anything, instead of working on the list society handed to us. We catalyze a chain reaction that little by little makes more room in the world for people who live all sorts of different lives. Over the last few years, I've started to see Data as a tragic character. The part of me that's working hard to accept and appreciate who I am desperately wants to see Data accept and appreciate who he is. He's not less than human. He's different from humans. Data's human-shaped hole at the center of his personality has been my human-shaped hole, too. I thought it was natural and virtuous even to want to be something other than I am. For a long time, that hunger to be other than I am shaped my self-image and goaded my self-judgment. Wanting to be someone I am not had, or maybe has, a significant impact on my quality of life. More than once, it's convinced me to go down courses of action that have left me anxious, depressed, non-speaking, and metaphorically burnt to a crisp. And that's almost inevitable when we assume that certain identities are, without question, bad different rather than mere different, to use philosopher Elizabeth Barnes's terminology. As long as I believe myself, an autistic woman, to be bad different, I'll keep pushing myself to overcome. But when my belief shifts, when I can stop trying to overcome and accept, even celebrate, my mere difference as a perfectly good way of being, that's when I start to really live and explore my potential. My potential isn't limited by how I'm wired. How I'm wired is my potential. Otherwise, I'm just a bad copy of myself trying to avoid the autism-shaped hole in my life. I want to invite you to Rethink Work, a new cohort-based course that I'm teaching starting on February 22nd. During our 8 weeks together, we'll rethink beliefs about work-life balance, productivity, data, passion, purpose, and the path to success. I designed this course to reveal brick by brick how our beliefs about work and our identities as workers create the work reality we exist in, so that we can tear those bricks down and build something better. You'll gain both the critical framework you need to notice outdated beliefs and apply those frameworks to make practical changes to the way you work every day. To get all the details, go to rethinkwork.club or click the link in the show notes. That's rethinkwork.club. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the